Hi, I'm Meredith.
And I'm Katie.
And you're listening to I'm Not Scared, You're Scared,
a horror movie podcast.
If you're a fan of the show, please like and follow us on iTunes and Spotify and review us. It'll help spread the word.
Also, you can follow us on Instagram at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared, or email us at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared at gmail.com.
Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
We're here to talk about one of our first divisive episodes, probably. The Substance, released in 2024.
Yes. And, oh my goodness. There's some marital drama from the window.
Happening.
There were middle fingers flying.
To slap him in the mouth.
Yeah.
Later.
I got to remind you, you are technically a newlywed for the first full year of your marriage. So you've got like 2 months left.
Yeah. Well, that's fine.
But yeah, The Substance. We're here to talk about the super new movie, The Substance. Yeah.
And it's nominated for best film, best director, screenplay, makeup, all sorts of things.
And Demi Moore already won the Golden Globe for best actress in a musical comedy. That was her Golden Globe category, which I thought was interesting. I mean, I guess there's some comedic elements to it, but we can get into that. And then she's got her Oscar nod.
It's satirical, most of it. But it's interesting. Well, this director, I'm so butchering her last name. It's awful, but she did one movie before this. I can't recall the title. I probably should have prepared it, written it down. But it won a lot of like independent awards and accolades and stuff. And then this one's a heavy hitter. It's pretty crazy. And so she's like the ninth female director ever nominated for an Oscar, which is, it's pretty cool. Even if you don't enjoy the film, that's pretty mind-blowing.
It's great to see that, like, every now and then the video clip comes across my feed where Natalie Portman and Ron Howard were presenting the nominees for best director, and Natalie Portman made a point of saying, and here are all the all-male nominees,
here are all the men.
So, and like, you can see Ron Howard like kind of chuckles but looks visibly uncomfortable with the fact that she made that statement.
I mean, like, I didn't really particularly enjoy Greta Gerwig's version of
Little Women
or Barbie. I can't remember what she won an Oscar for. I enjoyed Barbie. It was fine.
I think Lady Bird.
I'm like, that's fine.
Yeah.
But I'm supportive, you know, right? Like, I think that's awesome.
And there was nothing more satisfying, and I don't remember her name, but James Cameron's wife, who won for The Hurt Locker when it was up against his film. Avatar. Avatar, that was the thing. It was like the culmination of a project, like a dream project of his for like decades. Yeah. And he finally brings it to fruition. And then he goes up against his ex-wife and she wins.
Literally, this never happened. Sweet justice.
Yes, let's
revel in our pettiness.
Yeah. We're girls.
I know. We're petty. We're petty little bitches. No, I'm kidding.
Before we get into our in-depth analysis of The Substance, what's new with you, Meredith?
I've discovered something kind of weird.
Oh,
but not.
Is it a lump?
Not. No, thankfully, no. There is a whole genre, or not a genre, but like people are, like, companies and stuff are creating horror-themed perfumes.
Oh,
so I thought that
they smell like viscera.
Yeah, well, one is called like blood and stuff like that, but
like dead bodies soil themselves. Like, are soil. We?
Well, there's like cemetery. But I watched. I can't remember who the YouTuber is, and she does like reviews of movies and too. And then she's like, "There's also a whole group of people that order these. Have creators and people who really are into horror themed perfumes. I had no idea. And there's one particular company." And I sent the link to Victor and I was like, please don't take this as I want you to buy this for me.
Right. This is not one of those hints.
No. But the packaging is insane. And they had like six different scents. Mm-hmm. But one was like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. One was American Psycho. And they come in like these very large VHS container type thing.
Yeah.
Tape containers, mm-hmm. and it has, it's like kind of really cool revamp of the cover yeah. of the movie, and the inside is, and it's like supposed to be inspired by the movie.
Character,
the movie. So it was like Texas Chainsaw Massacre was like dirt, cedarwood, like whatever you do in like Texas.
Meat.
And then, or like leather. Leather, bourbon-y leather smell. And then.
So that's for the gentleman.
The gentleman, I guess. And then they had like American Psycho, and it was like, I can't remember the sense, but it was wild. I was like, this is crazy. And,
creative.
One was like Trick or Treat, because you know that mm-hmm. that very culty kind of movie. I've watched it so many times as like a fun movie to put on when I'm like folding laundry or something. I don't think it's like mind blowing. It's just fun. Mm-hmm. But there's just like, you know, autumn, apple, like, because it's pumpkin. Supposed to be, like kind of that themed. But I was like, this is the craziest thing. And, so that was kind of cool. But they had another perfume company called Heretic. Mm-hmm. And they do a lot of other scents, not just like horror themed. But they did a collaboration with Nosferatu. Oh, no. And they have a Nosferatu perfume. And these are not like junky perfumes. Like each bottle's like $130, $140. Oh, like made with very high quality, like nice ingredients. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I got some samplers that I ordered. Oh, and I'll get them hopefully before we, meet next time, and I'll give you a review. But one was called like Season of the Witch, and it had all these weird, like one scent is called Poltergeist. And I was like, yes, I'm very excited. Cemetery, noir, and they're very like earthy kind of complex scents.
Yeah.
And then, so I dived into that, and I was like deep diving into Reddit last night, because I was like, I don't know why this is so interesting to me. Aww. But everyone has to know.
Yes.
So by 10 listeners, now you know. And Katie knows.
Now I know.
But you don't wear perfume anyway, do you? Or I don't know.
No, I don't wear perfume. I have like a couple of, you know, Bath and Body Works body spray things, but I generally just use them if it's like, oh, this like hoodie or this sweater hasn't really, maybe needs to be washed, but I want to wear it today. So I'm going to give it a little light dusting. You know, I don't wear it on daily.
I'm a closeted perfume addict.
Yeah.
I have probably.
I love the idea of perfume, and I love the fragrance of perfume. And like, this last hotel that I stayed in Monterey, I walked in and I was like, this smells like one of the Gap perfumes when we were in high school. It was either Dream or Heaven, one of the two, because I remember like everybody was all about the Gap perfumes when we were in high school. It was when they first started making them.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, they say that smell is the sense that's most closely linked to memory in your brain.
I think that's why I like it so much. Yeah. Yeah. Because I kind of will wear something that I used to wear in my teens, and it just takes me back. And it's still a very lovely perfume. Yeah. It's not like, oh, I love to smell like raspberries. It's like it's like a Dolce & Gabbana, like a really high seller perfume. Yeah. So it's fun. I don't know. Yeah.
I just remember my high school boyfriend wore Michael Jordan had a perfume at the time.
Oh, nice.
There was actually like a 3D bulge on the bottle of a basketball. fortunately, I don't encounter that fragrance often anymore but that's another one where the perfume that my oldest brother wore when he was a teenager, like because he wore CK1.
Oh, I love that one. Yeah. I actually have a bottle because I ordered it purely. No, I didn't even order it. I think I saw it at Marshall's. So I was like, I'm like $12 for nostalgia. Yes, hell please. Yes.
So I paid a lot more for a lot less.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so that's my weird thing. What's new with you?
Well, actually, that kind of makes me feel like I want to share something along the same lines of just like fun horror things and the paths they take you down. Because so I have a friend, she's a friend from high school, still lives in Sacramento. And I've mentioned on the podcast before that there's a little group of us, like high school friends, that get together. It used to be every summer. Now we're trying to do it. We say quarterly. So like, you know, four times a year.
Yeah.
And only one of them, Abby, hi Abby, actually listens to the podcast. But Emily, she is very into, she's one of those like horoscope, crystals, tarot, like kind of person. And she's a really, really talented artist. And she actually has, I think, worked most of her adult life. The career that she kind of stumbled into with her artistic nature was tile design. Mm-hmm. She works for like a tile company, like designing these really high end, like bathroom scapes and putting together like the different products to make a really beautiful finished product of a room that, you know, incorporates a lot of like marble and tile products. But anyway, so she's like really into this. I don't even think you call it a cult. Is tarot considered a cult?
Or is it like, I don't think so. It's just fun. But I mean, some people take it very seriously.
Exactly.
Yeah. So and either you can have different perspectives of it, like think it's a fun hobby and be like, take it with a grain of salt, or this is like going to happen to you.
I think she's kind of in the middle. I think that she gives a little bit more credence to it than I do. Mm-hmm. But she's not like, that it's not like this is truth. This is gospel. This is real. Like your Mercury's in retrograde. We're all going to die. Like, I feel like she's a reasonable level of enthusiasm and buy-in for it. But anyway, so over the years when our girl gatherings have happened, like sometimes she'll bring her tarot deck and be like, I'll do you guys readings. And nobody's ever really that into it. Mm-hmm. She usually pulls them out pretty late at night. And then like a couple people are like, well, I'm headed to bed. For Christmas, one of the sweet, sweet, sweet girl in my class gave me a horror movie tarot deck. Mm-hmm. So it's a classic tarot deck in the sense that it has all of the representative elements, but they've all been redesigned to, and it's not to look like actual horror films that have been made. It's like basically, if this tarot card was a horror film, what movie would it be? Would it be a mad scientist? Would it be a demon? Would it be, and so it's really creative and the cards are very artistic and interesting. Mm-hmm. And when she gave it to me, I was like, oh my God, this is so thoughtful, because obviously they all know that I'm really into horror movies. But I was like, shit, I have not been paying attention to Emily and I don't know jack about tarot. But I told my student, I was like, okay, you've inspired me. I'm going to learn some more about tarot. And so the last time we got together, four of us in Sacramento a couple weekends ago for Emily's birthday, actually. And we stayed over a night in a hotel and Emily had her tarot deck. And I was like, perfect, because this time I'm ready to learn.
You can tell me.
You can do, yeah. I'm.
Tell I am, me all the things.
I am a vessel for you to pour your tarot wisdom into. And she's one where she's familiar enough with all of the cards that, she can just kind of riff off of them and like explain generally what they mean. But she was teaching me about like the four different suits and then, what they all symbolize and everything. But before we even started, I was like, I like cups, because obviously at this point I was already pretty drunk. Like cups is my, I want 10 of cups. Woohoo. I just like the sound of it. Right. Mm-hmm. And she goes, oh, well, cups are emotions. I was like, that's amazing. And then we get to like the two of cups is like the happy couple. And then the 10 of cups is like the like perfect harmony. And like on the classic tarot cards, it's like this happy family with two little children dancing in a circle. I'm like, oh my God, that's us. And so I started really identifying with some of these tarot cards in a very surprising way. Mm-hmm. And then I came home and I went on Amazon and I found myself a deck because, like my horror movie deck, there's lots of different versions where the art is different. Mm-hmm. But there's kind of the classic traditional illustrations that go with each element of the deck. And so I found one of those, but it was like a beginner's deck. Mm-hmm. So all the things that Emily just knows about what each card represents is like printed on the deck. And then like additional stuff of like, if you're like, it has the zodiac signs that would align with that card. So if you're doing someone's reading, like what zodiac sign they are affects how you would interpret the cards.
It's a Cliff's Notes.
Of course.
Cliff's Notes for cards.
Exactly. And so it's got all, it's like got the traditional image of the card, like kind of smaller in the center, and then the whole perimeter of the card is filled with text explaining it and like how to read it and if it's upright, if it's inverted and all those things. And it made me think, isn't Jenny really knowledgeable about tarot too?
Yeah, I think she got me for my 40th a few decks of something.
Yeah.
I want to say tarot, but it's in my closet.
Yeah. And yeah, I definitely not to like.
I'm like against it. I'm just very lazy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, who could do this when I'm researching horror themed perfume?
Exactly.
A very busy woman.
Yeah. And so again, like I would say Emily's in the middle in terms of buy-in. I don't believe at all that it is an actual source of fact.
Yeah.
But I'm viewing it now more as like how the entertainment value, like how it can be fun, like as a card, because some tarot decks, when I was reading about the history of it, like around the world, they're just for playing cards. It's not for divining. Mm-hmm. And that's why some of the suits and the cards and everything align a little bit with our traditional playing card deck. But now I'm kind of like, yeah, like I want to learn something. I want to be able to do this. Like, this seems kind of fun. And so mm-hmm. now I'm thinking, like, if I could practice enough, maybe like at the end of the school year, I could it'd be pretty funny at a Catholic school to bring in a tarot deck and do a bunch of readings for my students.
I'm sure everyone would be thrilled.
Yeah, that's going to be me tossing a match over my shoulder as I leave at the end of the year.
You're like, bye. Are you leaving at the end of the year?
I don't know.
Are you thinking about it?
I'm thinking about it. We always get a Google form from our principal around, I always thought it was kind of later in the year, but we got it this last week. It's just the intent to return. And it's just like, are you planning on coming back? So that she can start making plans. And then if you're interested in shifting to another, like a different position or a different role, mm-hmm. you know, inviting people to let her know that they want to have a conversation about where they'd like to go from there. And, you know, it was never a plan that I was going to be at this school long term. Like, our kind of strategy on the outset was that I would stay there until Grace graduated from high school. So we were like, you know, both kids be out of the nest. And our plan at that point is to probably move. So we wouldn't be right by the school. So, but now it's kind of like, there's so much bullshit. And, you know, it's like some days I'm like, this is amazing. But more often I'm like, what the fucking hell am I doing here? Like, I wasn't supposed to be here today, you know?
I wasn't supposed to be, yeah. Like Clerks.
Yeah. And I still, like, I get.
Whatever you like when you kind of took the position, you're like, ah, we'll see.
Yeah.
You know, very not like I'm here for life. It's exactly. Like, you know, until I want to not be.
Yeah. And I think part of that is because we're not completely reliant on the income, fortunately. I mean, we're very, very fortunate in that department. And it's been extremely helpful the past couple of years because both kids are at a private high school that has an ungodly tuition. Mm-hmm. But Tommy's graduating this year. And then we'll be moving into the college fund era of paying for him. And we'll be done with club sports because neither kid will be playing club sports anymore. And so, obviously the second income would continue to be nice. It becomes less necessary in the coming couple years. And so, you know, it's kind of like, it really is, do I want to be here? Like, is it worth it to me? What is the value and the experience for me? Yeah. And I do love it. And I also recognize that every year you do this job as a teacher, you get a little better. You mm-hmm. perfect what you're doing a little bit more. And obviously every group of kids is different and unique and causes you to rewrite your script in some way. But just like everything that I've tried and tested and refined and improved and figured out, this doesn't work, this does work. All of that I've invested in the past 4 years, it's like, okay, well, if I stop teaching, I'm just kind of throwing that away. Whereas in theory, if I continue every year, it should get like a little bit easier and a little bit better. And I'll feel like I'm doing a more effective job of my goals.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of bullshit.
Yeah. I mean, you guess how, if you don't have to necessarily stay at this position, you know, it's definitely something to weigh the pros and cons. And yeah. If it's worth the headaches, because it's a lot of headaches.
It's a lot of headaches.
And bureaucracy, mm-hmm. which is, that's the part that bothers me.
Yeah. Well, and especially what Pacifica
public school, too.
School district is going through these mm-hmm. past couple weeks is not.
Yeah. It's been honestly draining about like just the budget cuts, schools closing, and yeah. You know. Yeah, so.
Yeah, that's definitely more serious than the kinds of things that bother me about my job. Mm-hmm. But my plan is that even if I decide not to return to full-time teaching is like, you know, that there's a substitute shortage.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And to just say, I don't want to come back as a classroom teacher next year, but I'm, because we would still be living right a couple blocks from the school. I was like, just put me down for a set. I would probably, you know, be there every week.
Sure.
With the frequency that teachers need. And we know that teachers need subs way more often than they actually get them because it's just not worth it sometimes to try and find one.
Show up with a fever mm-hmm. suppressed by ibuprofen and all the medicine mm-hmm. than write a sub plan right now.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I remember writing sub when everybody. My lung collapsed. I was like laying in the emergency room on oxygen writing sub plans. It's like,
yep.
It's, and I mean, I know that they're, you know, they're, in theory, as a, an instructor, you should have your lesson plans already prepared in a manner where even if, you know, you died suddenly in a car accident, somebody should be able to come into your classroom and pick up the slack. But that's not how any of us operate.
I mean, I have a box in the a book room that's like, some plan in case of emergency. If, in case I was like incapacitated, unconscious in the hospital, yeah. there's like a week of stuff.
Yeah, they like, but they like not... smash the glass with their elbow and pull it out.
In case of emergency.
Yeah.
We're learning about caterpillars.
It's a week of caterpillars, kids. Yeah. Oh, okay. So,
well, keep I think me posted. That, I'm interested to see what you would want to do next.
Yeah. I mean, those would be, it'll be one of those two things. Either I'll be going back in the same role as a classroom teacher next year, which I think is very likely. But if I don't, I would expect that, yeah, I would just add myself to their, sub list and probably get.
You can always pop into Pacifica's sub list.
And see,
but I mean, it's a few hundy in a day, $100 in a day, right?
It's good pay. That's something to sneeze at,
right?
But yeah, I think that the only, the reason that I wouldn't do something like that is because subbing at my school would be like zero effort at all because of how familiar I am with the environment and the kids and the way it operates and everything.
Fine.
Whereas, and that was what I remember before I got my first teaching job, like, at, you know, back before I had the kids, and people were like, oh, the best way to, you know, get hired within a school district is to put yourself on the sub list. And yeah. I was like, yeah, so I've never had my own classroom before, and I'm going to throw my hat in to, like, just walk into someone else's and run things? Like, really?
Yeah, it's fine.
But that's what people do?
It's fine.
It's fine.
It's no big deal.
No big deal.
Don't be a baby.
I am such a baby.
Don't be such a baby.
No, I am such a wuss, I swear. But anyway, let's get to the movie.
Okay, this is a long one because the director doesn't really have a whole lot of dialogue, and everything is symbolic and very well thought out, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of intent. So prepare yourself.
For me talking two beverages the next, in front of me.
I'll be and talking for the next 20 minutes. Okay.
Only 20?
I don't
Mine
know.
Are usually
I'm
going like
to talk
40.
Really fast.
Well, don't. No. Savor
I'm talking so fast. Okay, so it opens with an egg on a blue table. The yolk is injected with an antifreeze looking substance in a needle. It's like a neon greenish yellow color. And a clone yolk emerges from the egg. Next, we see a sidewalk and the name Elizabeth Sparkle placed on the Walk of Fame. And by the way, if you're new to this podcast and you see, oh, the substance, I'm going to click on this. I'm going to tell everything that happens. So new listeners, just keep this in mind.
If you haven't seen this and you have any intention of watching it, turn this off.
Yeah, this is a fully spoiler filled.
Oh, yeah.
Podcast. So anyway, so our perspective is looking down as we see a ceremony for the star. There's a passage of time, fans taking photos of the star, then people walking over the star and saying, oh, my mom likes that actress, or, you know, kind of as time moves on. Eventually, the star is cracked and older looking. And eventually, you see an unhoused person walking over the star with a shopping cart. A tourist drops a burger drenched in ketchup onto the star, leaving a large, messy glob of ketchup smeared all over the Elizabeth Sparkle star on the Walk
of Fame.
Which
has lost some of its sparkle.
Yes. And then we see a beautiful older woman who is Demi Moore hosting a fitness workout. Very, who's that actress? She's much older. Jane Fonda. It makes me think of Jane Fonda, kind of.
Yeah, when I look at, like, here's a woman that's 30 years older than me and looks hotter than I've ever looked in my entire life.
My whole life, yeah. The fitness show is called Sparkle Your Life. The fitness session filming ends and people are wishing Elizabeth, or she refers to herself as Lizzie. So later I'll refer to her as Lizzie as well. But they wish her a happy birthday and she's walking down a long red corridor with large framed photos of Elizabeth Sparkle and various iterations of her time hosting this fitness show throughout the years. It's like lining all the way down this long, long hallway. She has to use the bathroom and finds the women's bathrooms closed. So she goes into the men's room. She goes into the stall, and then we're introduced to a repulsive character named Harvey, probably a reference to the repulsive person who is Harvey Weinstein, who runs
this
the show.
Dennis Quaid.
Played by Dennis Quaid. Beautifully. He's wearing like a Dolce & Gabbana suit. He's very loud. He's obnoxious. He's yelling into his cell phone mm-hmm. about replacing Elizabeth. And he laughs about her being around since the 1930s during King Kong. He's like, I don't give a fuck if she's an Oscar winner. She's probably, you know, like she, I want her gone. Lizzie emerges from the bathroom stall and peers into the bathroom mirror, taking stock and looking at her face. As a viewer, we see she's gorgeous, but then she's also older and she's not the shiny new thing.
Yeah. Do you think that it was like, well, maybe you know, the idea of casting Dennis Quaid in that role because he's somebody who was a heartthrob when he was younger.
Yeah.
And now, like, we still love him. He's still yes. entertaining and a great actor, but his face don't look great.
I know. I think, well, let me quickly do an aside. He replaced Ray Liotta, who died 3 months into filming when they were doing this
movie. They've been filming this for that long?
They'd filmed it for a long time.
Because Ray Liotta's been dead for like 5 years.
A little less than that.
Really?
I think they did a year and a half of editing and stuff like that.
Wow.
But he was filming this movie.
Okay.
And then they had to kind of find a good name mm-hmm. and person to kind of replace him. And that took a little bit of time to get him in there. But that is a good point. And I kind of...
And the same would have been true of Ray Liotta.
Yeah.
Like, he was, like, you know, a gorgeous man when he's young. Like, those piercing eyes. Like
I loved him in Goodfellas.
Yeah.
He was a legend.
That was definitely, like, his major accomplishment,
I think, in
his career.
Yes.
But then, like, and he, I feel like his face held together a little bit better as he got older. But, like, Dennis Quaid got that real, like, droopy look.
I think it's
to the skin on his face, which is like the thing that women have to fight against.
Yes. I think that some of the point, and I'll kind of talk about this a little bit later as well, but just the idea of men being like, ugh, you women, you're getting older.
Gross.
Meanwhile, they look the way they do.
Right.
And
they just keep getting saggier and saggier.
But the perspective a lot of times is women, men age like fine wine and women become old hags that are irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we do. That's just,
it's the truth. We gotta stop doing that. Apparently.
Well, so, here's how.
So, you know, the next scene is Harvey having lunch with Lizzie. He's repulsively stuffing his face with shrimp.
Oh, so gross.
And he says now that 50, you know, she's not relevant anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, now that she's turned 50, you know, she's not the person that he wants hosting the show anymore. He bails on her to go be chummy with another guy in the business, leaving Lizzie at the table as she peers into her glass of wine that has a fly drowning in it.
Yeah.
On her drive home, she spots her billboard being taken down, and then suddenly she's T-boned at a light. Luckily, she's okay, but she looks pathetic and hunched over on the examination table, and then at that point, she kind of breaks down and starts crying.
Yeah, I love that. Like, the doctor's
so
trying to, like, talk
so
to her.
She looks so small and, like, tiny.
Be complimentary because he knows she's a celebrity, and then she just starts sobbing. And he, like, does that guy thing of, like, has absolutely no idea how to respond.
Yes.
Doesn't treat her like a human. Doesn't acknowledge that she's, you know,
having feelings.
In pain. And just, like, you know, Homer Simpson's back into the hedge.
Yes.
And off he goes.
He's like, oh, no, my beeper did a thing.
So that I did a thing.
The doctor quickly leaves. A male nurse who has a birthmark on his hand asks, hold on, can I examine your back? Because the doctor is like, you're fine. You know, luckily you're unscathed. Mm-hmm. You're very lucky. You can go. And she's like, well, I thought I could leave. And he's like, well, hold on. And then he examines her and he says, you're a perfect candidate. He hands her mustard yellow coat back to her, which becomes a pretty, like, it's a kind of its own character in the movie.
Yeah.
And she finds a note inside that says, this changed my life. And there's a flash drive. She's, you know, kind of wonders what it is. And she's walking out of the hospital. And she's spotted by a former classmate, a guy named Fred, who tells her, you know, you're just as beautiful as I remember. You haven't changed a bit. And he writes down his number and he drops it in the muddy water and hands it to her. And he's like, please call me. Like, I'd really like to catch up. And she's like, kind of like, okay, maybe.
Yeah, she's being really polite. And he's not being like gross or
no.
Like, it seems earnest. But I think the thing that surprised me in that moment is from the beginning of the movie, I assumed Elizabeth Sparkle was a stage name. And he comes up to her and he's like, Lizzie Sparkle. Like, that was her name back in high school.
Yeah.
I'm like,
it
was this
very...
like her last name was actually
Sparkle? That'd be awesome.
Well, you kind of have to become a fitness instructor at that point.
So she goes home and there are flowers with a note that says, thank you for all the years with us. You were amazing. And she looks out of her apartment window and decides to finally watch what's on that thumb drive. There's a narrator that says, have you ever dreamt of a better version of yourself? Music plays in the background and the message continues. Younger, more beautiful, more perfect. One single injection unlocks your DNA, starting a new cellular division that releases another version of yourself. This is the substance. You're the matrix. Everything comes from you. Everything is you. This is simply a better version of yourself. You just have to share 1 week for one. Hold on. 1 week for one and 1 week for another. The perfect balance of 7 days each. Don't forget, you're one. You can't escape yourself. And that's the end.
Yeah.
So she takes the drive and just says, well, that's trash, and throws it in the trash can.
She's like, damn that L. Ron Hubbard always trying to find new ways to get to us.
I know. Enough already. Enough of Scientology. So later that evening, it's her birthday still. Like, this is the longest day ever. She downed several martinis alone at a bar. She looks over at a couple. She seems pretty lonely. Later at home after vomiting, she washes her face. She looks in the mirror. She looks at all of her awards and then a snow globe with glitter inside that has a girl figurine inside, and it says Elizabeth Sparkle. And she hurls the snow globe at this very large framed photo of herself. Oh my God,
it's enormous.
It's massive.
Yeah, it's like maybe 20 feet high.
Yeah, and it's like her in her aerobic instructor garb.
Pose.
And she looks amazing in it, but I guess
it's also obviously not a super recent picture. Like, it's a slightly younger Demi.
Yeah.
You know, like in her 30s maybe, as opposed to her, you know, now her. Well, she's in her 60s, but her character is supposed to have just turned 50. Is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah, she's 61, I think. But God, if I look like her when I'm 61,
I want to look. Mia. I want to have looked like her when I was 25.
I know. So at this point, she calls the number, the phone number, and because she has retrieved the flash drive and she orders the substance. She awakens the next morning and takes a shower, takes an Alka-Seltzer, reads the newspaper. She spies an ad in the paper looking for her replacement, and she crumples it and tosses it into the trash can. It's looking for a woman aged 18 to 30. And she goes through her mail and finds finally a black package with two yellow half circles. There is a key card inside, and she goes to a very shady pickup spot that it's like the door opens halfway. She has to crouch under every time to go get her. It's a very sterile mailroom looking place and to grab her package.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know, like 25 or 30 different like little mailboxes.
Yeah, it's and very her, like black market.
Yeah, and her key card is, what is like 503?
But she's patient 503.
Yeah, so she like uses the key card to get in and to go to her mailbox. But then it's like the presence of other mailboxes would be like, okay, these are all the other people that are participating in this.
Yes. So at home, she unpackages all of these items. There's an activator and a vial that says single use. It looks very similar to the antifreeze looking substance from the first scene. And then it also says discard after when use. Activator for other self, a food matrix for herself and other self. She takes out directions and one card says you activate only once. You stabilize every day. Another card says you switch every 7 days without exception. And then remember, you are one. Later that evening, Lizzie is nude and getting ready to use the activator, and she's in her bathroom. She activates herself with it and waits a few moments, and nothing happens until something does happen, and she's bent over in pain in the bathroom and writhing kind of like in a fetal position on the ground.
Yeah.
We get a view of a lot happening at once. Something emerges out of her back. Her pupil multiplies to two. Lizzie's back splits, and then there's two eyes in her eye sockets. There's a tunnel with blurring, flashing lights, and a heart of flame. And then her other self emerges from her back, and it's a young and beautiful woman played by Margaret Qualley. We get a first-person perspective from this other self, and she looks into the mirror and is very happy with what she sees. She inspects her body some more and is very satisfied. And then she sews up Lizzie's back, which is a gaping wound. And, of course, the camera viewpoint is very close in this sewing job, and she's finally finished, leaving a long trail along Lizzie's back of knots of thick black thread. The next morning, the young doppelganger gets ready for the day. She realizes after getting a nosebleed and ear ringing that she needs to use the stabilizer, which comes from Lizzie's spine, who's still naked on the floor for some reason.
Yeah, she just leaves her laying there naked on the floor.
She stabilizes herself, and the vial is large with large plastic units, 7 in total, 1 for every day. She decides to go to the casting call for her replacement, and she... finds a metallic pink leotard in a department store window and purchases it for herself. She introduces herself as Sue.
Which I'm like, oh my God, really? That's the name?
Yeah.
Like, you pick any name in the world she's and like, she's like,
I'm Sue.
She's like, I'm Esther.
I'm Esther. So the casting directors love her. Harvey loves her and tells her she's a gorgeous little angel. And he hires her and tells her he's willing to work about any scheduling issue because she tells him, I have to take care of my mother every other week who's very sick.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of to explain why she's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we see her new billboard for the show. She's having a ball with this new body. And as the real language, as this is happening, real Lizzie is languishing on the floor, unconscious and immobilized.
Has she already put the food matrix into Lizzie yet at this point?
I think so.
Because there's like a bag and it kind of looks like semen, big old bag for each of them that they're supposed to be like hooked up to while they're the one that's not active. And yeah. I remember wondering because Once Margot Qualley emerges, like, or Sue, once Sue emerges, like, she sews up, you know, Lizzie's back. She, you know, puts the needle in and starts giving, like, the food to Lizzie as the Matrix and everything. Like, she seems to know what to do. And I remember asking Tom, like, do you think that she just has some sort of inherent knowledge, or was there an explanation of this process that the director, declined to show us that it was supposed to be assumed?
I kind of had the same question because I would have been like, I need more like YouTube directions to tell me needs to be injected.
I would absolutely be Googling like, how do I feed the Matrix?
Yeah, what do I do? It's this Matrix mix.
Yeah, because in theory,
what's Matrix mix up?
Yeah, wouldn't even know the word Matrix refers to Lizzie.
Well, it's all Lizzie, and it's like her. She's the first person, right? But that's the other
thing. Like, that was another thing that I kept coming back to is their consciousness was not shared. I mean, I'm jumping ahead.
Yeah,
but
I'll get into my own theories or like why I think things happen the way they did. But
yeah. So I think at this point she's already got the like big bag of semen food plugged into Lizzie unconscious on the floor.
Yes,
and that's like nourishing Lizzie, the shell of Lizzie, while Sue is the one that's active.
Yes, yeah. So we get a montage of the show being rehearsed, Sue stabilizing herself, and now we're at the you switch stage. The food matrix is almost done, and Sue switches with Lizzie. Lizzie awakens and is in pain because of her back, but she peers at the now immobilized Sue and brushes the hair off of Sue's face kind of tenderly. I think she was satisfied with the experience.
Result.
Yeah. Lizzie eats. She goes back to, pick up things from her workplace. Harvey hands her her box of her stuff and a wrapped gift, commenting, "Everyone chipped in for it. My wife swears by it. It's Fred." Like, that's how he talks. It's so like over the top and obnoxious. He mentions that everyone was wondering where she went and half-heartedly says he wanted to have a drink with her. And then he makes his quick exit because he is, and I said in my notes, a piece of crap, and leaves her with the box. Later, she marks her calendar with her days that she's herself and Sue's days. And then she just waits the 7 days. She's watching TV, keeping herself busy in her apartment. She gets another letter notifying that her refill kit has arrived. Lizzie goes to check on Sue and sighs. She's kind of looks down and sees there are 2 days left. She's like, you can tell that she's just kind of biding her time.
Mm-hmm.
Now Sue is up and is walking around Lizzie's apartment, realizing that Sue was sitting on her butt and watching TV the entire time. She was not activated. She kind of looks disgusted, just kind of... Really?
Well, that's why I feel like there's no shared consciousness, because every time one wakes up, they're discovering what the other one had done.
Yes.
They don't know until they see it after they've switched.
I think it's, well, I guess I can tell you my, do you want to say what I kind of think this is going on? I think they are sharing consciousness, but it's also like the high that she's getting from being her other self. Maybe it's like kind of supposed to be symbolic of an addict doing things that they shouldn't be doing, or not like waking up the next day and be like, oh my God, did I really do that?
Mm-hmm.
Or did I make that decision? Or like, I'm eating a bunch after like drinking all night or all day, or doing drugs and I ate all day the next day. I can't believe I did that. To me, that was kind of that. Felt like that a little bit. Not like I'm completely unaware, but just like, I can't believe what the hell am I doing?
Yeah. And that does support like that idea that you are one.
Right. Because you're the same person, but are you really the same person when you're under the influence or an addict or not able to control yourself,
right?
Make these poor decisions or, I don't know if that was the director's meaning or if that's actually true, but that's just what my kind of interpretation was of it. Let's see, where was I? So at this point, she decides to create a closet for the inactive Lizzie. And there's a lot of construction and noise, and she gets banging on the door, and it's the neighbor ready to lay into her until he sees Sue. And at that point, he's like, oh, so she's like, were you going to come yell at me? He's like, no, no, no. I was going to ask if you needed help. And he's like, you know, as soon as
I've got a big hammer.
And he's just kind of smarmy. And she's like, yeah, anyway, slams the door in his face.
Yeah.
And she's made a big closet that goes right behind the bathroom.
Yeah, she has some really, really extensive contracting skills.
Yeah, she's
like
amazing.
It just completely disappears when it's closed. It's got like hidden hinges, hidden activator. It just looks like a bathroom wall when it's closed.
It's fantastic. So then Lizzie's body now can stay behind the closet, in the closet behind the bathroom. Then we get a quick glimpse of the eyeless, one of the eyes is missing, of a photo of Lizzie. It's eyeless because of the snow globe that she hurled into the framed photo on the night of her birthday when she's all like pissed about everything, like her firing and her age and all that. We now get to see Sue's new show. It's called Pump It Up. With over-the-top aerobics, people in metallic leotards, Sue ends the workout and then uses Lizzie's trademark goodbye and wink.
And blowing a kiss.
Yeah. Harvey's thrilled and Sue is happy and pleased with herself. The posters of Lizzie are now in the hallway that were once there. They're now all gone. And there's only one poster with Sue and her new show hanging up. Sue dresses to go out and then tells Lizzie, wait for her, knowing she's supposed to switch soon. The food matrix is almost out.
But she wants to have one party night.
Yes. But she goes partying with her friends. She picks up a guy. They return to her apartment while Lizzie is running short on time as the bag is nearly sucked clean. Sue gets a nosebleed and has to stabilize herself, even though that's a no-no. And she returns to her hookup and unzips the back of her outfit and entrails come out splattering onto the floor. But that was kind of a dream, the entrails part.
Yeah.
And Lizzie awakens to find Sue immobilized next to her. Then she emerges from the closet and she sees the apartment trashed and a note from her hookup on a post-it on the window. She reaches for it and finds that the hand and her finger look gross and withered. She tries to wash her hand and the gross texture and color is still there and it's there to stay.
It's like a single old lady witch's finger.
Yeah. She calls the number and explained what's happened. She's like, there was a misuse. And I call the provider. That's what I call it.
Okay.
The provider says there's no going back. Lizzie tries to blame Sue and explains, you know, Sue is drunk. The provider says they're one. They must respect the balance. And when you take one from one,
it can't be reversed.
Lizzie finally gets to watch Sue's new show and she doesn't look happy. The neighbor tries to pick Sue up now and that the show is premiered. And I said, ew, gross.
And then Dennis Quaid's character, like a perfect example of the way that men treat women based on their appearance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like how the neighbor's attitude made a 180 when he was expecting it to be the old bitch from across the hall and it turned out to be this gorgeous hot young woman. And then Dennis Quaid, like the way that he treats Demi versus how disgustingly gushy he is about Sue's character.
Yeah.
And it's just like they're all human beings, they're all people, they're all, you know, but the way that they're treated is 100% dictated by their appearance. And that obviously that's an exaggeration. I'm not suggesting that like that's how everybody in the world actually is, but it's a reality.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's like you're a commodity to be owned or to be
used up until
fawned over until you're not relevant anymore.
Yeah.
So yeah, she's pretty upset about her gross finger. And so then she picks up her refill kit and she's startled at the pickup location. And so she runs into a cafe and grabs a table. She spots a patron and he says, "It's long, isn't it? 7 days."
This old guy.
And then she recognizes his birthmark on his hand and realizes it's the handsome nurse who gave her the drive. I guess that was his ulterior.
His perfect self is a doctor. Yes.
So she asks if he was following, were you following me? And he goes, "Well, you know, it's just, you know, it's lonely to be doing this. And it gets harder to remember that, you know, you deserve to exist and you're still worth something and matter."
Yeah.
And Lizzie's like, "I'm fine. You know, I don't know what you're talking about." But she's clearly uncomfortable and she, you know, tries, she decides to leave. And, She's on her way out and he says, "Has she started it yet, eating away at you?" Which is a little bit of a big foreshadowing. It's kind of like the limited dialogue. Like if someone's saying something, it matters a lot.
Yeah, it's really important.
Right. So she runs into Steve's hookup, who looks at her very disgusting and belligerent. Like, who's this old hag who deigned to be in my way? And he's like, "Get the fuck out of my way." And, you know, because she's invisible to him. Mm-hmm. So she goes home and finds Fred's number and they make a date. He's really happy. He's like, "I just can't believe you called me. Like, I didn't think you would, you know, can we meet up at 8:00? And she gets ready for a date. She looks beautiful. She's wearing long black gloves for obvious reasons. She adds her finishing touches at 7:30. She's about to leave. She goes to get a quick look. And then at Sue, she sees the billboard of Sue. So then she goes back to the mirror and primps some more and satisfies. She turns off the bathroom light. Then she glances at, oh wait, no, excuse me. She looked at Sue, her body, mm-hmm. or I guess her like
the shell.
And then she primps herself. Then she's on her way out again and she sees the billboard this time and she really takes it in and she goes back to the bathroom. She seemed really confident, and then she starts covering her body up. Like, she puts a scarf on, she reapplies her makeup.
And she mutes her makeup.
Yeah,
She's like, "This is too garish," or this, like, you think she can, she's thinking, "This is too youthful, like, I'm trying too hard, I should, you know, tone myself down and cover myself up."
As a viewer, we're like, "She looks good."
Yeah.
Like,
what the hell are you
doing? She reapplies her makeup, she turns off the light, she's ready to leave, but she stops at the door. Sue's image is just haunting her, and she returns to the bathroom and just violently starts removing her makeup, just hating smearing herself.
It. Yeah.
It's visceral, just so like how sad. Much, like, like how repulsive she finds herself.
Yeah.
And the next scene, we see her just despondent, wearing her robe, sitting on her bed, and we see her phone lighting up as Fred is sending her a text, and they're ignored.
Like,
and
you almost here?
Are you almost here? Like, are you running late?
Is everything okay?
Mm-hmm. And then Lizzie is back to eating. And now Sue is active and filming her workout show, and a weird lump pops out of her hip. And it makes her jump an alarm. She gives the excuse that she was distracted, and Sue's freaked out. And everyone is about to watch the playback, of course. You know, because they're like, the director's like, "Something weird happened." She's like, "Well, I gotta go." Like, she runs to the dressing room.
I mean, we should also notice that, like, her workout show is like watching porn.
It's basically like, yeah, very, like, very sexual. Everyone's basically almost showing their parts.
Yeah. And like the cinematography of the whole film is really based around like super close ups, really zooming in on, or like unique angles. Like, we get multiple angles from like up from the bottom of the trash can, or like really like kind of creative, different viewpoints of things.
Yes.
But then like Sue's entire show is like, "Zoom in on your vagina, zoom in on your butt, zoom on your
like vibrating."
Yeah, like, and she's like twerking and everything, like the hyper close-ups on like her, like the butt and the genitalia and everything. It's like, this doesn't really seem to be fitness forward.
Yeah. Well, it's doing great though, don't you know?
I wonder why. I bet you it's a bunch of people trying to get fit watching it.
I'm sure. So Sue runs to her dressing room, gets the lump out of her hip and then through her belly button.
Ooh.
And it's a chicken leg.
Oh, and that part was so gross.
So then Sue awakens and finds that Lizzie was eating just for days. you know, while she was active. There's just like food everywhere.
Yeah, plates and carcasses.
Yeah. So Sue calls the provider and complains that Lizzie was just sitting and eating on her ass for 7 days, and he doesn't offer the thing anything aside from, you have to respect the balance. And she's like, thanks for nothing. And so she goes to work.
Such a man.
Yeah. She goes to work and is very nervous to find that the taping is canceled. And then she's asked, you know, you need to talk to Harvey now. She comes in kind of like, ooh, trepidation, but then he's thrilled. And the host, the show is doing amazing, and he wants her to host the New Year's show. They have a few months to work on it. Are you in? And she's like, yeah, you bet I am. So I'm sure it'll be great. She takes more time than she's supposed to from Lizzie. Mm-hmm. And she uses more and more stabilizer out of Lizzie's back. And she's like, I'm on the cover of Vogue. I just need an extra day. I just need an extra day. Yeah. So then her back looks awful, by the way. And Lizzie's,
oh, yeah. Every time she's sticking that needle into the hole in Demi's back to pull the stabilizer out, it just keeps getting more like septic and gross and
it's
infected
a big
looking.
Blue, gross, disgusting, abscessy looking
so
back.
So wrong.
Yeah. So she calls. Oh, hold on. Let me go back. Lizzie's finally awakened to find that she's looking much, much older and she has a decrepit leg. She calls the helpline and says Sue is not respecting the balance. She's stealing more and more and more time. Mm-hmm. And he offers her for her at this point. Now that she's there's no going back for her. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, well, you know, you can stop.
You can cancel whenever you want.
But she can't seem to let it go and stop. She finally opens the gift she got from Harvey and her coworkers. It's a French cookbook. And she starts cooking all the dishes and watches Sue on an interview. She's pissed and hilariously mocking Sue as she cooks this food, which is very gross. Yeah. It's like blood sausage and like tripe and all the sorts of stuff.
Blood orphans.
Yeah, blood orphans. The interviewer asks if Sue was a fan of Elizabeth Sparkle. And Sue is very condescending, saying it is old-fashioned Jurassic fitness. Mm-hmm. And then Lizzie plunges the mixer into a giant bowl of eggs and splatters herself in egg yolk. Lizzie's pissed because Sue is taking her beauty from her, and she's just majorly losing it. She's like, you want to tell them where you get your beauty? You're getting it from me. Yeah. Like, you're full of crap. You know, so she's majorly losing it. The apartment's trashed with food and newspapers, and they're all over the window because she starts, like, hurling eggs at the TV and on the windows.
Well, there's this part where she, like, paper mache's the window, too, so that she can't see Sue's billboard.
Yeah, she's sick of that crap. but then at this point, Sue is awakened, and she just can't go back. She's like, oh, hell no.
In this moment, I stopped and asked Tom, I'm like, why does she have so many fucking plates?
Because she's a famous actress.
Like, when Sue wakes up and sees just, like, the wreckage of this French culinary adventure, you know, that Lizzie went on, it's like, there's 100 plates laying around with, like, leftover food scraps and all the dishes she made. I'm like, who has that many plates? That's like you and Neve Campbell brushing her hair and screaming. I'm looking at it being like, why are there so many plates?
Who knows? It's a crazy... Her place is disgusting.
You're
so
like,
I
Katie,
don't know.
You're focusing on the wrong thing.
No, I get it. I get it. Trust me. So she's gone and she's just plunging that stabilizer needle, getting as much fluid from Lizzie's back as possible.
Yeah, she like drains it all at once. She's like filling up a bunch of random mason jars with it.
Which I'm sure is very sanitary. Mm-hmm. So she... Then there's a big title card that says, now 3 months later. And Sue is thrilled with her new year's show is tomorrow night. There's a handsome fellow in the her apartment saying, when are you coming to bed? And she said, soon. And then she goes to get stabilizer because she's getting ringing in her ears, nosebleed. And, you know, we see her go get it from Lizzie. And there's all the used food matrix bags on the ground surrounding Lizzie. But you don't actually see Lizzie yet. It's just kind of obscured. Unfortunately, there's not enough stabilizer fluid, and so Sue calls the provider and says, you know, you've reached the end, because she's like, there's no more fluid, and he's like, you reached the end.
The only way to regenerate the fluid is to switch.
Yeah, you have to switch,
and
she's like, there's no fucking, she's like, there's no fucking way I'm doing it. He's like, well, that's the only way.
Yeah.
So, and he's like, it has to enable the fluid secretion process. You know, so she's desperate and she's, you know, she's basically crawling over to Lizzie to reverse and reawaken Lizzie. So Lizzie wakes up and she's grotesque.
She's a hag.
She's like The Shining, the woman from the bathtub. The Shining.
Yeah, but like, except way hunchbacked.
Worse. Hunchbacked. And she tells her boyfriend, you know, Gilas, get the fuck out of here. And he is like, ah, like runs fleeing because she sounds insane. And then she looks, you know, she looks into the mirror and realizes like what has happened to her. She has no hair. Her spine's completely deformed. Her legs are just grotesque.
Her skin is gray. She's just
her boobies are like flaps.
Oh and my God. She's like so sad.
You see her ribs. It's insane. And then Lizzie calls the provider and she's like, I have to stop.
I have to
cancel it. And he says, you'll get your delivery. So she disguises herself kind of like a babushka.
Yeah, she's like wrapping, just covering every part of her.
And she runs kind of like a gremlin out.
She's like lumbering down the road.
To the pickup spot. And she's running about town. Then she goes and comes back home, drags Sue's body to the living room and injects her with the termination injection. And she starts to. She starts to inject. And you hear the provider's voice saying, are you sure? And then you'll just be on your own. Mm-hmm. And she's like, yeah, I'm fucking sure. And then she starts to press the plunger and then she stops herself. And she's like, I can't live without you. I hate myself, basically. She tries to resuscitate her, saying she can't. And she wants Sue to come back. So she prefers the switch. And then Sue awakens and sees a conscious Lizzie for the first time. They're both looking at each other. Mm-hmm. This is the first time that they are both awake. And Sue sees the termination syringe. And before Lizzie can explain, she starts to beat Lizzie to death in a very wild fight scene. But we, as a viewer, get a glimpse of something happening to Sue as she starts kicking Lizzie to death. The "Remember, you are one" title card flashes on the screen with other wild imagery of like, you can't really do this.
Yeah.
But then she does. Lizzie's dead, I think. Yeah, she's like on the ground, and it's a very violent, crazy scene. I don't have enough time to describe everything that happened. So at this point, Sue goes to the studio. She looks beautiful and she's getting dressed for the New Year's, show. She's in a giant blue dress. And I thought of it more as like a quinceañera, like blue dress.
It did. Yeah, totally.
And then lo and behold, her ears start ringing. Her teeth start falling out. And then her ear falls off. She realizes, you know, she got to get out of there. Yeah. She's falling apart. But not before she runs into Harvey to says, smile. You have to smile.
Pretty girls should smile.
So she smiles with her mouth very closed because she's missing all of her front teeth. Sue starts remembering the substance and she starts, you know, once she's gotten to the apartment, she starts dreaming of a better self version of herself.
Yeah. 3.0.
Yeah. So she returns home and she uses the activator, which clearly says single use only. And she injects herself and begs, I need a better version of myself. But you know, you can't clone a clone. And she is a clone and finally emerges and grotesque. And it's Sue and Lizzie mashed together as a monster, similar to something you'd see in The Thing
What did they name it? The title card was like Monstro.
Yeah, I have it here.
Lizzie.
Yeah, let me see. Where is it? I'll read it because I know it's in here.
Yeah.
So Lizzie and Sue are mashed together as a monster, similar to something you'd see in The Thing, like I said, or like Scanners or The Fly. And we're flashing back to the casting guys who cast Sue in the first place. The Lizzie-Sue mashup is called Monstro Elisa Sue.
Elisa Sue, yeah.
So she dresses up and puts on the dress because she's not missing her party.
Oh, my God. And she's just like, and it's almost like from Goonies, Sloth, like Sloth's girlfriend.
It's so satirical and over the top. It's ridiculous.
The face part is supposed to be Margot Qualley still, I think, but you can only see like one eye or whatever. Like it's so obscured. But then on her back, you have Demi's actual face, like popping out of the back, just like screaming in agony the whole time. Yes. And she's like pulling like blue tulle over the screaming face.
Yeah, she's like, shut up, you. Quiet. This is my night. So she, the Elisa Sue Monstroso, you know, she gets dressed up and she's ready to go. She cuts out the photo of Lizzie and adds eye holes and super glues it to her face and adds lipstick to the mask. She returns to set and is let inside somehow. This is why it's like, you know, ridiculous, satirical. Yeah. She imagines that everyone is applauding. Well, because like the audience is full. It's a big night.
But when she first walks down the hall, she's hallucinating people there.
Yeah, she's hallucinating.
There aren't actually people there.
They're not people there. She's hallucinating that everyone's there applauding. And but that didn't happen. She manages to get on the stage, though. Everyone is topless, though. All the dancers, showgirls are there topless,
like,
for this family-filled
kind of
event,
show.
I guess.
Yeah.
But once everyone can see her in the audience, and they're horrified, and they yell out at her, like, monster, freak! And then after they witness what looks like her giving birth to a breast, and she's like, sorry! But it seems like a callback to the casting directors, like, ooh, look at her nose. Like, I would rather have her boobs in the middle of her face.
Because it bulges out of her eye socket, doesn't it?
Like
you think it's an eyeball, but it turns out to be a boob.
A boob. But obviously it came out of her face, so it seemed to be like kind of a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek callback to that.
Boob and eye callback.
Yeah, so they called her monster. She tries to explain, it's still me, I'm Sue. But the audience attacks her, and she cries on the floor until finally someone decapitates her. And of course, because she's constantly growing and changing in an amorphous creature that shouldn't exist, a new head starts emerging and blood sprays all over the audience. And as this happens, we hear some of the dialogue from the movie about looks and age. And there's like metal music going, nee, 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 like that. It's crazy. The dialogue about looks and age kind of playing over this whole experience as this is happening with the audience as they're horrified as she is kind of experiencing this too. The monster runs out of the studio, but not before she sprays the hallway with a spray of blood. Very, you know, similar to The Shining, and the coloring of the carpet is very, it's like a nod to the Overlook Hotel for sure. Eventually the monster collapses and becomes a pile of parts. And the part that was Lizzie's face manages to squirm, kind of like the thing, like this, the crawling creature, and stops on Elizabeth Sparkle's cracked star on the ground. She looks at the stars and smiles and dissolves into nothing as she imagines applause and accolades from her fans. The next morning, the sidewalk cleaner just wipes what was left of her away. And that's the end of The Substance.
It sure is.
Did you find it scary and or repulsive?
No, not scary.
Disgusting.
Disgusting, 100%. There was, I wouldn't say I have a problem with needles. Like, I've gotten tattoos but like when I'm getting blood drawn or I'm getting an injection, I don't look, right? I look away because I'm like, what kind of psycho watches?
Victor like, does. He's like, oh,
let's see that. I'm like, so clearly I was not meant to be a phlebotomist.
Same.
There were definitely lots of moments in this movie that I looked away. Like, particularly you were talking about the needle into Demi's back repeatedly. Mm-hmm. When the scene where Sue is originally sewing up the back, the big gash in Lizzie's back, they really drew that out. They showed it like over and over. Like,
it was like a minute.
Yeah.
It was like
the needle going through the skin probably like a dozen times at least as she's putting these stitches in. And that was something where I kind of looked away a little bit from that. I thought that the story was so interesting and inventive and creative. I just hated the ending.
You hated that? Oh, yeah.
The monster part. And I think I was with it all the way up until the point where Lizzie wakes up as like the full on hag. So once Sue has been like, forget this, I'm never switching back, and she doesn't switch for 3 months. And then Lizzie finally wakes up after 3 months of just being sucked dry. I feel like at that point, the movie could have gone in a very different direction that to me would have actually made it feel more like a horror movie. As opposed to following the story, and obviously this is the message the director was trying to send. This was the story that they were trying to tell. about this plight and this struggle and the unfair and unreasonable attitude and expectations of women in society. And but then also to like just go way over the top.
Yeah.
And so it's funny because like the one word that resonated with me when it was over was that was ridiculous. And not necessarily at that point, I didn't feel like ridiculous in a good way. Mm-hmm. I feel like they had this really fascinating premise and they had built a story. And then the way that they decided to conclude it, I wasn't on board with.
Yeah. Yeah.
But really for me, the turning point was when Lizzie, and so even that, the point when Lizzie decides to terminate Sue and she's still having that struggle and then they fight, like even that I was still on board with. So maybe the moment that I would have liked to have seen something different explored was the creation of the clone of the clone.
Right.
Like Sue's decision to use the rest of the activator on herself, because that's when, to me, it got so ridiculous and laughable that I almost feel like it distracted from the message that the director might have been trying to say about like the the pain and the sacrifice and the impossible task that is set before women and what they'll do and what they'll go through to try and accomplish what society expects of them or demands of them. And I feel like that got lost in like this just total chaotic, ridiculous ending.
Right.
Yeah. But I believe you feel differently.
I mean, I did think it was ridiculous, the ending, but I think it was supposed to be. It's supposed to be like, what do you do when you turn yourself into a monster, basically, to kind of adhere to expectations of what people want of you or expect of you, especially in like Hollywood. But I mean, I didn't think, basically, I really enjoy, I didn't say like enjoy, that's a weird word to say for this movie. So this is not one I'll be watching like once a year or anything. Mm-hmm. Like it was, I felt like it had a lot to say. And I love that the director is a female, a woman who she was writing this and it was coming to grips with her approaching 50 and being like, I'm not relevant anymore. I'm not somebody who people look at anymore. And what do you do when you feel like you are not the apple of people's eye anymore, or like in the male gaze anymore? And even if you feel like you're not really concerned with that, it's interesting to see what happens when you basically become an invisible person, with little to no value, or you don't have anything impactful to say. So she wrote this, and it was like, I think it was supposed to be satire, and to me, I kind of put a note on my notes that said, this is very like Monty Python, it felt like.
Okay.
The scene of like the life of Brian when he's that huge, huge guy who's eating and eating.
In the restaurant.
And then he's like, I just need a mint, and then starts spraying
vomiting everywhere. Yes.
And everyone's like disgusted. You know, it's supposed to be ridiculous, or and it felt like, and to me, I was just like, that was wild. And I was like, well, that happened.
Yeah.
That was kind of the feeling that I had. I appreciated the nods to like The Fly and Scanners, Cronenberg's The Scanners and The Thing. This movie also really made me think of like Requiem for a Dream. Did you ever watch that
movie? I did, but not since it came out. So I really don't remember it.
It was definitely, I mean, I feel like the director said she kind of incorporated a lot of movies that had influenced her. But there's a lot of like ASMR, close up, like Dennis Quaid ate 4 pounds of shrimp to do that disgusting scene, you know, and his, you know, Harry, the main character in Requiem for a Dream, he gets that abscess and that gross arm that he has to have removed. And it was very, made me think of that when I thought of Lizzie's back getting injected over and over again. And then his mother, you know, Sarah, who's obsessed with losing weight because she wants to be on television, and she's just sitting in front of the TV. That's her life until she gets on basically amphetamines to lose weight and then becomes very paranoid. And, you know, that's a very sad, awful story. And it's a story about addiction from a few different perspectives, you know, who from the mother's point of view and then her son's point of view. So I felt like it kind of gave a new version of this, and but also incorporated the, you know, what it's like to be a woman in, yeah. in society, especially in an area like in California or like Hollywood, where yeah. your looks are your key thing.
Well, yeah, that matter the most. When you pursue a career that is so largely reliant on your physical appearance. So, like, obviously, anyone in fitness and anyone in Hollywood, an actor, even a singer, you know, female singers are expected to be just as gorgeous as if they were an actress or a model because, mm-hmm. you know, that's part of their brand or whatever. Because when you think about, you know, women in different fields with different careers approaching 50, obviously you still struggle with, you know, that the change in how society views you. But if your professional value up until that point was like, you're a teacher, right? And now mm-hmm. you're 50, you've been teaching for 30 years, your professional value is more respected mm-hmm. than it was when you were young and more attractive. Mm-hmm. So it depends. I mean, it's the career that you're in is obviously going to affect how much your physical aging is going to impact your experience.
Yeah.
But I was just kind of thinking the idea of, you know, professional athletes, you know, particularly football players, like their careers are very short because of what their bodies go through to participate in that sport. And so they kind of, you know, become quote unquote irrelevant in their professional capacity at a fairly young age for kind of a similar reason, not because they're not attractive anymore, but because their bodies aren't young enough and fresh enough to continue doing what they had been doing. But then the difference is that, I mean, well, I guess if you were like a superstar, like a recognizable individual for like a professional football player, then you get to go into commentating or you know, mm-hmm. you're on ESPN or whatever. And it doesn't, I mean, most of them aren't that bad looking, but you know, obviously they don't earn that second phase of their career based on their appearance. They earn it based on how successful they were when they were players. Mm-hmm. So it's not the same thing, but like there are professions for men where, you know, age very quickly catches up with them and changes what the future is going to look like for them. And yeah. for professional yeah. football, I mean, you know, what percentage of professional football players are not famous enough for anybody to want them to be a commentator? And then you're like, okay, well, you're 32 now. Bye.
See you never.
Yeah, like hopefully you secured enough money in the years that you were able to play to support you going forward for the rest of your adult life. And so I'm not suggesting that like the football player experience and then like the beautiful woman in Hollywood experience is the same, because there is a level of unfairness, I think, that is present in, you know, the woman, the female experience to like the male athlete experience. But I do see parallels there in terms of when you make a career that is based on something related to your physicality, mm-hmm. Then you deal with, you know, what happens when society's perception of your physical value changes, right. as opposed to yeah. a career that's based on your mental capacity, or abilities or skills, where that's something that grows over time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's kind of interesting that you mentioned this, because I just saw like a reel last week, and it was like, what if, you know, interviewers treated male athletes the same way they treat female athletes. And it was like, you know, do a twirl. Oh, that's a really tight outfit you're wearing. Mm-hmm. Like all these things that were just like so weird to me. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what if we said these things to the male athletes? And I think, I'm not sure if it was fake or real, but it was like, you know, a lot of times the questions were asked and the athletes were like, quick, get the hell out of here. Are you asking me that for real?
Yeah.
And it was like, why do we allow that
yeah.
for female, very, very athletic Olympians, yeah. like people who are definitely deserve to be there, and they're just being like ogled or asked stupid crap that doesn't matter and doesn't have anything to do with what they're doing and what they're able to do and yeah. their ability.
And there's a lot of women that have become known in Hollywood for calling people on that. Like Anne Hathaway is a big one, where if she's in an interview and she gets asked like some bullshit idiotic question, mm-hmm. she'll just be like, no, next question.
Yeah.
You know, Scarlett Johansson does that, like when she would do PR for the Marvel movies and often was the only woman on the panel with all of these other men. And if she got asked a question that was like, was she felt was sexist, she would just be like, really? Like, I'm not answering that. Like, you're gonna ask these guys that? Like, what? No.
Yeah.
And but I think
you're like, being considered, you know, difficult.
Exactly. Like, there are some women that are like, I don't care. Okay, call me difficult. Like, yeah. I've seen clips. Cate Blanchett will do that on the red carpet. Like, I remember there's one video where, like, the camera was, like, panning up and down her dress. And she, like, leans down to put her face in the camera field and is like, are you going to do that to the men? Like, what's going on here? Because they were just, like, basically looking her up and down with a camera.
Yeah. Well, there's just a separate set of rules. Yeah. Obviously, there is, you know, with everything. With men and women.
Exactly. And I'm like, we strive for equity, you know, equality is, you know, I don't know if it's possible. And I don't know if that should be the goal, equality. Like, now that we understand that there is a difference between equality and equity. Like people, these unfair things are like knit into the fabric of our society. And it kind of makes you wonder if it's something that's even possible to undo at this point.
Yeah.
You know, because each subsequent generation, you know, is getting a little bit more aware and a little bit more vocal. But then we also see the generations on the other side evolving as well, getting more close-minded, more just critical and kind of restrictive and uglier. And so it's not even like, oh, future generations will fix this, because while some parts of our society are evolving the way that we would want them to, others are regressing.
They're definitely doubling down on problematic ways of thinking.
Yeah, and trying to reinforce them and codify them into law in plenty of occasions. Geez. So.
There's one thing I love this show. It's called Better Things, and it's written by Pamela Adlon. And I'm a huge fan of her. And it's won some awards, but it's no longer like, you know, being made anymore because it kind of concluded. But there's an episode, and she, her character, and this is her kind of her real life experience as well, as like being a divorcee with kids in LA, and she's getting work, and she does voice acting and also on screen acting too. And then she has friends who are also in the business, but like kind of, you know, like have been in the business for decades and doing like comedy, other things. And there's one episode where they're talking about just kind of grappling with becoming an older woman in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And, you know, what it's like to become, lose the male gaze and not feel valid anymore. Mm-hmm. And they kind of, in the show, it's like they kind of have very, it's scripted, of course, but it feels like very organic kind of conversations where they're just like some friends. They've been in the business a while. They're drinking wine, hanging out. And they're like, I just didn't realize how much I took from feeling validated by a man. And now I'm basically invisible and I lost that. And I'm trying to figure out why I care so much about this and how much it's like affecting me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it made me think, I'm like, am I kind of that way? I think that because of who I am, because it's not, I don't do anything that's really in the public eye, of course. I feel validated when my partner, my romantic partner, you know, that's where I seek my validity and feeling like attractive or whatever. But mostly I want to be found to be funny and interesting. not like, oh, she's so beautiful, because to me, that's fleeting. And not to say women shouldn't feel that way, that's, you know, who you are, right? And you can't really change that. So I thought that was a really interesting conversation in the show, because I think it was surprising to the character. They're like, I didn't know that.
You don't realize how much it means
to you until it's gone. I didn't realize how much it mattered to me until it was gone, and I was out in public and I realized I'm invisible and nobody cares, and what do I do?
Yeah.
What do I do now?
Well, I think that does make sense, because you like mentioned, you know, the validation that you get from your partner, like whoever, you know, you spend your life with. And so if this character in the show was a divorcee and doesn't necessarily have a partner, like that, you know, that is a place where hopefully if you're in a healthy relationship, you would draw a lot of legitimate, genuine validation that would not just, you know, obviously like they think you're beautiful no matter what because they love you. But then they also know you and know all of the other assets to your character and your personality and your intelligence. And so the validation from a partner with whom you're in a healthy relationship is extremely powerful. And so if you don't have a partner, you are going to be looking for that in other places.
In other ways.
And again, I think, you know, it goes back to when you're talking about, you know, where you would feel validation is like, again, like in your profession, like as a teacher, like your validation comes from feeling accomplished, like seeing students' progress or seeing a positive effect that you've had on your school community or ways that you like you're going to pull validation from professional accomplishments that have nothing to do with your appearance.
Right. Yeah, you know? Definitely. And it's just a different animal, right?
Exactly. So it's not to say that like women who aren't in the public eye don't feel that, but obviously it's nothing compared to a woman who has made her career based largely off of her appearance. Because even if you're an incredibly gifted actress, we know you might never get your foot in the door if you aren't also beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So there's also a few interesting things I wanted to mention, but because I know this conversation could go on and on, but I did think it was an interesting choice that Margaret Qualley's mom, Andy McDowell, is notorious for not being somebody who participates or receives like any kind of plastic surgery, cosmetic alterations. And she's been very adamant and gotten criticism for like, why aren't you? And she's like, yeah, no, I don't need to do that.
Can you imagine criticizing a woman for not getting plastic surgery?
Yeah, it's stupid, right? So she's like, yeah, I'm not doing that. I don't feel like I need to and I'm not going to.
I mean, like maybe criticism if you are like shaming the people that do, like obviously that's not the right message to send. Like that would be toxic. So it should be like, do whatever makes you happy.
But the point is,
for her individual choice to not do it, I can't imagine being criticized for that.
Yeah. I mean, why do people have opinions about it one way or the other? Yeah. I think that's the big problem, right? Like if someone's like, a woman wants to, fine. If not, wait, we just did it. You know, be voicing our opinions about someone's appearance.
But when you become
that's the reality. Like, people will, but
when you're a public figure, you put yourself in a situation where like strangers feel like they have some sort of ownership over you. Mm-hmm. Because like your fan, like me, for example, like I am obsessed with Stephen King as a person to the point where I would be afraid to ever meet him in person because I think I would just freak out or freeze or something, like I don't even know. And so here's somebody where like he does not and will never know I even exist, and there are millions of people like me who he is important to us.
Yeah,
he is a person in our lives, he's a part of our lives, and he does not know we exist. And so like if when you're a celebrity, the world feels like it owns you in a sense. You belong to your fans in their minds. And so it makes sense that like then makes them feel like they're entitled to comment on your personal choices.
Yeah.
You know, because they feel like you belong to them in a sense because you are a public figure.
Yes, there's that. And then there's also the concept of like toxic fandom.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which is just gross.
Are you suggesting I'm a toxic fan?
You're not. Definitely not.
Because I don't want to meet him. I'm afraid to meet him.
You're afraid to meet him. But the idea that your opinion matters.
You know,
when someone does something or makes a choice in their life. But anyway, so I wanted to touch on that. And then I also watched the behind the scenes thing of the making of this movie, which was 45 minutes. And it was so fun to watch because it was like, of course, there's a lot of, you know, special effects and stuff like that. But like, there was so much just like body molds. There's
makeup,
viscera. They didn't even make the tunnel of lights with CGI. It was like very low on that. They had just like models. They had the back. They had people puppeteering on it. It felt like Romero, like people like pushing the back and like making it pulsate and look crazy and grotesque and stuff coming out of it. And it was like zoomed up close shots. And you saw like the limbs and even like the boob with the umbilical cord and viscera. It was wild. And then the big buckets, the drums of blood as the director. She was like in it, like covered in guts and spray and, you know, wearing the suit, the dress, the quinceañera dress all sewn mm-hmm. up with like the lumps of the Lisa's, you know, the monstrous, you know, and she's spraying the audience, including Dennis Quaid. And yeah. it was like such a wild thing. And then I also watched an interview with Guillermo del Toro and the director, and he's mentioned how he really appreciated that she didn't ever reveal who was behind the substance.
Oh, yeah.
It was very, he said it reminded him of
like it didn't matter.
That, and then it was like a fairy tale. It's like looking into the mirror and then not ever finding out what's behind the mirror, what's saying these things to mm-hmm. to the witch or the evil queen. Mm-hmm. And how he appreciated that so yeah. much, like what's behind the curtain, what's doing this. And he's like, in the United States, it's like, we got to know who it is, who's supplying this. But she was, it's a French film. It was made in France. And mm-hmm. so she didn't have to. But then she also talked about the difference between male director and female director. Like it's like female directors who have a perfect, precise vision are considered difficult. Mm-hmm. And men who are, have a perfect, precise, you know, vision of their movie are considered geniuses. Yeah. And he's like, never bend on this.
Never compromise,
like, you yeah. know, he's like, cause he's a legend. We love him. Right. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I loved this movie. Where it went, it was wild. I was like yelling in the theater, like, and it was really crazy. But you know, never kind of bend to what other people expect from you
yeah.
from a female director. So I thought that was a really fun interview to see as well, from like a horror icon who's produced a lot of stuff too. Mm-hmm. And then this is her first major, you know, accolade movie with yeah. a bunch of nominations and all this stuff. So we'll see if they win. I kind of have a feeling, yeah, but you know, I appreciated what this movie made me think about. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it was pleasant.
No. And it's interesting to see Hollywood responding to it, since it's kind of, I mean, it's an evisceration of Hollywood.
Yeah.
Like it's putting the spotlight on them and the way that they treat women. And so it's kind of cool to see them hopefully recognize that and validate it. Mm-hmm. Like maybe even like this is something that should change, or this is something we're striving to change, because we have seen inroads. With the representation of women, other cultures, you know, other backgrounds in filmmaking, getting more opportunities and getting more recognized.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, not that I would call Hollywood self-aware, but for it to respond so positively to a film that's kind of saying, like, you're a piece of shit, Hollywood.
Well, I think it also calls to everybody, or it resonates with women and men too, in a lot of ways, especially like the bathroom scene where she's like, I feel fine. Okay. I'm ready to go. No, I got to change this about myself. Like not mm-hmm. just like that dissatisfaction and just kind of like hatred of yourself.
Yeah.
I'm sure I felt that. I don't really feel that way much anymore, but probably in my 20s, like when I'm finding myself and who I am, you know, everyone's kind of grappled with like, what is not attainable? What do I have to be okay with?
Yeah. And like, how that changes as you get older. I'll never forget seeing some tweet at some point in the past where it was like, I wish I was as fat now as I thought I was in high school.
Right.
To that idea that mm-hmm. like, and me knowing that I was like self-conscious about my body, my weight, like everything in high school. And I look back at me as a senior in high school and I was like, who am I fucking kidding?
Like a tiny.
Are you joking?
Cute.
Like, oh my God.
I'd barely seen the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like totally.
And then at every point in your life, you know, you're feeling dissatisfied. Mm-hmm. Like there's always something that you wish were a little different or a little better. And then you get 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, and you look back at that person and you're like, God, I wish I could go back to that.
Yeah.
You know, because that's just what aging is, and that's mm-hmm. natural. But because of, you know, the expectations that have been ingrained in our psyches,
especially elder millennial yeah. women.
Yeah. And then reinforced by the way society responds to women in all sorts of different atmospheres. in arenas, it's like,
yeah,
it does feel like a losing battle. It's like a lose-lose situation sometimes. Sure. It's really hard to, and we, you know, we both have daughters and it's like, you want them to feel beautiful and know that they're beautiful, but also know that they don't have to be beautiful and their beauty isn't just what they physically look like, but like to validate, like to do that, to do validate both of those things at the same time and try to protect them from that toxic narrative entering their self-talk.
Yeah.
Of my value is my appearance. And if my appearance changes or if my appearance diminishes, then so does my value or so does my worth. Like it feels like a losing battle to try and raise a girl to have that, like a just positive self-talk, a positive inner monologue.
Especially in the era of social media and what, and these little chunks of stupid bullcrap that's like, you know, gets into your mind and kind of lives rent free in your mind about what you should look like. And I think I want to say at some point, Charlotte mentioned something like, oh, I wish I looked this way. And I was like, you know, and I wasn't talking down to her. I'm like, when I think about how I looked in high school and how I wanted to change myself and what I was not happy with. And I think back about like how wrong I was when I look back. And, you know, you might feel that way and that's valid, but, you know, kind of also keep in perspective that that's not all that you are.
And the joy that you're robbing yourself of by feeling unhappy because of something like that, when if you were able to just set that aside, like and how much more rewarding the time that you spend could be if you subtracted that self-criticism and the unhappiness that comes from being dissatisfied with your appearance.
Yeah. It's an interesting conversation for sure. And this movie definitely brought up a lot of things. And I think that that's why people are, you know, responding so much to it, maybe in good ways or bad, but it's definitely causing feelings to happen for basically everybody who's watching it, either disgust or like, oh, I've totally felt like that before or whatever. But
well, generally conversation is a good thing. Like that, that is a big element of moving things forward and change happening is starting a conversation, starting a dialogue. So, I mean, it certainly is going to, you know, about, has gotten people talking.
Talk about allegory. That's what I felt like the monstrous Sue, Alyssa Sue, was like, maybe plastic surgery gone bad or what happens when you really, really, really buy into this? Like, what do you do to yourself? Who do you turn into? How do you treat people? What would you have done this under other circumstances? You know, I think it's an interesting conversation and it was supposed to be crazy and over the top and disgusting. But,
it's also you do more and more and more and more trying to please others, and you eventually, in that effort, turn yourself into something that they loathe.
Yikes. But anyway.
Well, that was cheerful.
It's fine.
It's fun.
At this point, if someone's listened to this whole thing, at least watch it. I can't even begin to have described that. I mean, I did,
I did
the best I could.
You will have an opinion.
I did the best that I could describing it, but I know I missed a lot.
Well, like you said, it's so visual. And so there's only so much you can do to describe something that's as visual as this.
And then after you watch it, watch the behind the scenes, how they made it, because it's insane. It's so fun.
That, where is that
available? It's just on YouTube. Like, making the substance with the director's name. And it was really cool. It was filmed in France and very wild and all that. But so, good conversation.
Yes.
We are going to come back and talk about
something lighter.
Something sci-fi horror.
Yes.
Of Event Horizon. It was released in 97, yes, I want to say. And has Sam Neill and some of my favorites. And
Lawrence Fishburne.
Some of my favorites. Yeah. Jolie Richardson and some other. I forget his name, but he's in Harry Potter, and he's been Isaacs.
Jason Isaacs.
Yeah. I love him too, with his piercing eyes.
Yes.
Anyway, we'll have a fun, lighter conversation
for Event Horizon.
All right. Bye.
Bye.